I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am, but Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hello and welcome to Seriously, the podcast from The New Statesman that takes pop culture seriously.
I'm Caroline Crampton.
And I'm Anna Leskovich.
This week we're going to be talking about the final episode of Girls and Channel 4 documentary The Knowledge.
We've also tried the true crime podcast My Favourite Murder for the first time, so we'll be talking about how that went later in the show. Hello.
Hello.
Welcome back to another episode of Seriously. Seriously, a weekly podcast. Normally there's not much space between us actually recording the thing and the thing going out, but as you're listening right now, I'm hopefully enjoying myself in Vancouver. So this is like a kind of pre-record, though every week is to an extent a pre-record.
Yeah, so Anna's going on an exciting adventure to a pop culture conference.
Pop music conference.
Pop music, okay. Yeah.
In Seattle, which is super exciting. Some friends of the podcast there, and just an opportunity to go to presentations on things like Justin Bieber's relationship with Christianity. So I am fucking thrilled. And I'm making a little detour to Canada as well halfway through. So hopefully next time you hear me on the podcast, you'll hear like the glow of someone who's recently had a luxurious holiday in my voice.
Yes, I look forward to that.
One thing that is on the horizon in the very near future is our very exciting Twin Peaks quiz. Yay!
Yeah, we're super excited for this one. And also a little bit nervous, if I'm totally honest, because it's not completely in our wheelhouse like Harry Potter is. So we need loads of you to turn up and support us and make us not feel like total dweebs.
Yeah, but it is going to be really, really fun. It is going to be hard. It will be exciting and a great geeky evening out in our wonderful venue, the Book Club in Shoreditch, which we just love. We love the Book Club.
It's such a good place. It's so, so atmospheric and it's so nice. And you can get food and drinks and everything while you're quizzing. It's really good. Definitely join us. You can get tickets by going to seriouslypod.com/events. All the details are on there.
So the first thing we're going to talk about this week is Girls. The long-running, much-discussed HBO show Girls began over 5 years ago in 2012. Wow. The finale of Lena Dunham's sixth and final series, titled Latching, aired this week. I'm really sad. I know that Girls has been a show that has provoked a lot of discussion and a lot of criticism, some of it extremely fair. But although it's imperfect, it's just a show that I've come to have a really like long-running and feels like very intimate relationship with, and I'm super sad to see it end.
So I've had quite a different experience with Girls to you, I think, in that I was super into it for the first 3.5 seasons. And then for a reason I cannot remember, and I actually went back and read all of the episode summaries to see if I could work out what had triggered me stopping watching it. I just stopped and haven't watched it again, but have now come back for the final episode, having not watched anything that had happened.
Wow, that must be an experience. Well, I think seasons 3 and 4 were a very mixed bag of TV.
My best hunch as for why I stopped watching it was the Richard E. Grant cameo.
Yeah, that was a sort of weird plotline. I think, does Jessa meet him when she's trying to become sober at one of her meetings?
So the last episode I remember really enjoying is the one where Adam and Hannah drive upstate to get Jessa from her rehab. And that's quite a good road trip episode.
I feel like that's maybe the finale of season 3.
Maybe, yeah. And
is that also the episode where she's trying to give someone an assisted suicide?
Oh, yeah, I think so. But then anyway, the Richard E. Grant thing happens and I don't know, I think Jessa was always my least favorite character anyway, and I was just like, not in for this, and just never went back to it. Yeah, so watched the final episode almost like out of context, and it was so good. I think really want to go and watch what's happened in between now.
Yeah, I do think it kind of works as an isolated episode. And lots of people, including Lena Dunham herself, have said that this is more an epilogue than an ending to a series, which I think is probably quite true. Because when I was thinking about, right, how would you imagine Girls to end? Like, how would it go out on a bang? I think of something like Hannah, Marnie, Shoshana and Jessa all dancing together at a party, even though they've sort of accepted that their friendships are dying. Which is what happened in the penultimate episode of Girls. Mm. So that was really what you'd expect from the series, I think, in terms of a kind of bittersweet New York finale. And then you get this.
Yes, which, as you say, yeah, it feels like an epilogue. It's a two-handed drama with a small amount of input from Hannah's mum. But it's Hannah and Marnie in Hannah's new house upstate. It's several months after Hannah's baby's been born, and you know, Marnie's trying to help her get used to being a mum, and you know, they're going to doctor's appointments and talking about breastfeeding, and yeah, and the main like emotional trauma of the episode is Hannah's struggles with breastfeeding, and she's convinced that her son Grover hates her, and that's why, having breastfed fine for a month, he now won't do it.
So it's really an opportunity for all of Hannah's kind of long-running insecurities and almost weird selfishness to come out. Meanwhile, her dependency issues are sort of creeping back into the picture because she's completely reliant on Marnie to do everything for her. And I think Hannah is a character who has sort of been reliant on different people over each season, whether it's Marnie in the first season or Adam in the second or Elijah. She really leans on people. And it's interesting to see her and Marnie together sort of trying to work through that and trying to get to a point where Hannah's able to care for this baby on her own, which I really liked. But I agree with you, it's kind of out of sync with the setting and just the general vibe of all the other seasons of Girls. One of the things I really liked about this episode is the dialogue between Marnie and Hannah, which is so familiar because over six seasons of seeing these characters kind of have these very intimate, loving arguments, you get into the rhythm of their dialogue. Mm-hmm. And at this point, they're having the same kind of arguments. Like, there's a line where Marnie says, "Promise me you won't stop trying to breastfeed," because there's a reason that they call it liquid gold. And Hannah says, "Well, if you really thought that, I thought you would at least agree to taste mine," which you won't. So, and it's like a very typically them argument. It's very familiar to me of their conversation in season one, where Hannah's naked in the bath and Marnie's shaving her legs, but with a towel on. And Hannah's like,
"Yes,
are you going to take your towel off?" And she's like, "No." And she's like, "Oh, but you always see me naked, when really it should be the other way around." In this instance, they're arguing about something other than themselves, which really goes to show for me how far those characters have come, how they suddenly are now in a stage of their life where there are more adult concerns at play in their relationship, even though they're arguing about them in very much the same way they always would. So I really liked that kind of development of just like very slightly changing the dynamic, because they're not just arguing about each other's bodies, they're arguing about what's best for Hannah's baby.
And there are some interesting stages in the episode in Hannah's processing of, as you say, her dependency issues and various other things. So Marnie calls Hannah's mum at one point to come and help, and they have this really memorable and very good argument where her mum is following Hannah around the house when she's like in the bath initially, and then she's getting dressed, and then she's going downstairs, and the whole time the camera's just following them, and they are arguing about how much of the way Hannah is her mum's fault. And her mum's trying to say like, well, that doesn't matter now, because you just have to get over it because you have a son and you have to look after him. And then there's the encounter that Hannah has with the girl out on the street, when Hannah kind of storms out and goes for a walk, and she meets this girl who initially she thinks she's been really harmed because she's sort of screaming and crying and she's come running out of her house and she's not wearing any pants or shoes. And then it quickly becomes clear that the girl is just a teen who's acting out because she's been told to do her homework and she doesn't want to, and she wants to go hang out with her boyfriend. So Hannah like flips into maternal mode immediately and starts like, well, your mum doesn't say these things because she wants to, she says them because they're good for you and you should do as you're told and blah 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 blah. You see the click in her own brain. She was like, oh, this is why.
So yeah, it's definitely all about Hannah's motherhood. Some people have said that that's kind of a cheap way to shift a program about arrested development into a gear where it's suddenly the characters have grown up, because well, it's maybe, like, motherhood is the ultimate shortcut to being like, well, now you have to take care of someone else, you can't just worry about yourself anymore, young lady.
Maybe we could compare it to Gilmore Girls.
Yeah, I think productively it could be compared to Gilmore Girls, and there was a great piece in Vulture that we'll put in the show notes that does just that. And I think as a pattern, it's kind of worrying, right? Because I think, like a lot of things in TV, you can see within the context of the show and within the specific decisions the script writers have made, something can make sense. But when it becomes part of a larger pattern of like seeing this used as a way to make women grow up on TV in general, that's when you're a bit like, is this kind of a bit worrying and kind of not really a nuanced way of looking at character development?
You're right. It's interesting as part of a broader trend. It isn't fair, and it has never been fair, to hold Girls Up as the one TV show that must say everything about women all the time. Mm-hmm. Because as you mentioned in the intro, Girls has very productively for media companies generated many web column inches of hot takes and
including
think pieces.
Own, I have to say, about, hands up.
About what it is and isn't doing in its presentation of women and other groups, as it were. As you said, some of that criticism has been wholly justified. The show has at times been not very good at race. But at the same time, as our colleague Stephen Bush has pointed out, it's not that surprising that in the, you know, posh, well-off, essentially white world that these privileged characters move in, it's not that surprising that they don't have black friends, you know?
Yeah, exactly.
But what's always been the case is that for peculiar reasons, maybe the fact that the show is written and directed by an unashamedly very outspoken and public woman, the show's always been held up for all of its sins.
Yeah, and I do think a lot of the criticisms have been fair, and I do think seasons 3 and 4 were especially ropey. The last two seasons I've just found to be absolutely brilliant, like definitely the best the show's ever been. Seasons 5 and 6, I've spoken on the podcast before about how much I really loved the betrayal of Hannah by Adam and Jessa as a plotline, not because I particularly liked Adam and Jessa together as a couple, though they do have this fantastic chemistry. For me, that they don't have quite as great chemistry as Lena Dunham and Adam Driver, who it just doesn't make sense. They don't even visually look right together, and yet they just have this really brilliant on-screen chemistry. But that plotline has been so good as just an opportunity to explore Hannah's kind of vulnerable side, Jess's guilt, Adam's indecision, all these things kind of coming into play. And I'd really recommend going back and watching those episodes, because they're just so, so great. And yeah, really great for Lena Dunham's acting as well, which I think at the beginning of the show people were a bit like, is this woman a good actress or not? But I think it's, you just can't have a doubt about some of her performances towards the end of this show. They're absolutely amazing.
That was definitely very visible to me, having not seen any of really the interim, as it were, last having seen her act like 2 or 3 years ago at the end of season 3, and then seeing this episode, I was like, whoa, she was just so much more in command of everything. It was really good.
Yeah, she has some really great, really, really vulnerable scenes over the last two seasons. So I'm super sad to see this show end, because I mean, I always get sad when things end, and I am someone who's like really obsessed with mortality and aging and death, so it's probably partly to do with that. I remember the first time someone recommended Girls to me, and I was at university and I was hanging out with a friend who is now my really good friend, but at the time I thought he was so much cooler than me, and I like wanted him to be my friend. And a friend of his came over, this very like charismatic camp guy, and was like, oh my god, you must have seen Girls. How could you have not seen Girls? Anna, you're such a shosh, like you've got to watch it. And I was like both kind of embarrassed about being called something that I didn't know what it meant and wanted to find out what it meant, and also was like, okay, got to be in the zeitgeist, like these cool people are watching this show. So I watched it, was obviously really offended that I'd been called a Shoshana, though I did grow to love her. But yeah, and since then it's just been like absolutely one of my number one shows in rotation, one of the shows that I will watch weekly when it comes out. And I've had such a relationship with these characters, and it is kind of brings a tear to my eye to see the ways that they have got older on screen and they have changed. And the show's been criticised quite a lot for having bad character development, but actually I think it kind of sneaks up on you the way the characters develop in this show, and by the end they have all of a sudden.
I also have hopes that it's the kind of thing that will get a movie reunion in 5 or 10 years time, because I think Lena Dunham and Adam Driver are already super famous. Lots of the other people in it are definitely going in that direction as well. But they obviously all really love the show and love doing it. So I think it's the kind of thing that, with the right kind of production win behind it, could get a really, really good movie reunion.
Maybe, though I think from the way that they took those relationships at the end, there's nowhere else for them to go. They're pretty much done. And I think that's one of the things that I found so sad about this finale, was that it wasn't like Friends where you see them all walking out of the apartment holding hands and you know that when the screen stops playing, they're still going out and living their lives as a group. Or like The Office UK where Tim says, oh, the camera stops rolling, but I'm still here. It's not really an ending. It was an ending. All these characters basically kind of agreed that their relationships were over, which is real and probably reflects the reality of many people's 20s, which is that at the end of their 20s, they're maybe not friends with the same people they were friends with at the beginning of their 20s. But I still found it really sad, but in a good way. Like, it was a proper ending to a show. And it was nice for change, I think, to see a comedy really end and say, yeah, this is where this program finished.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Rebag, your premier destination for luxury resale. Elevate your style with our curated collection of bags, watches, and fine jewelry. At Rebag, quality is our priority. Each piece meticulously vetted and verified by experts, ensuring your investment is nothing short of perfection. Buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Hermès, Chanel, and Cartier. Access expertly crafted and hard-to-find pieces that redefine luxury. Your next investment awaits at Rebag. Get 10% off your first purchase with code REBAG10. That's 10% off the luxury you deserve. Don't miss out. Head to Rebag.com and enter code REBAG10 at checkout. That's REBAG10.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas, big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
Delicious.
You get a fast car. I want a ticket to anywhere. Maybe we make a deal. Maybe together we can get somewhere. Any place is better. Starting from zero, got nothing to lose. Maybe we'll make something. Me, myself, I got nothing to prove.
Now we're going to talk about The Knowledge, which is a Channel 4 documentary about the secretive exam process that drivers must pass in order to become black cab drivers in London. It follows several aspiring cabbies as they try and make it through the four-stage test, which involves having instant recall of around 100,000 London landmarks and streets.
Yeah, so I sort of knew about, quote, The Knowledge, almost in the way that you would learn a piece of vocabulary. Like, I knew that it meant knowing London like the back of your hand, and it was a thing that you could ask taxi drivers. You could say, like, to a black cabbie, do you have the knowledge? And that would mean that they would know exactly where to take you in the quickest amount of time. But I'd never really thought about that as a concept, which is that anyone who drives an iconic London black cab should know that level of detail, which is really, really insane when you start to think about it. It's something like 25,000 roads and 10,000 places of interest.
No, more than that. It's 100,000.
100,000.
100,000 landmarks.
I'm not good with numbers.
Yeah, and then I think more roads as well. Like, yeah. It's a ridiculous amount you have to memorise. And of course, it's not just a question of memorising a list of names. You have to memorise them all in relation to each other.
Yeah, exactly. So the idea is that they can say to you, you know, where's the Royal Society of Greengrocers or something really specific like that. And they'll be like, oh, Mom, that's on Leopold Street. I really loved the way that they all said mom and sir to each other.
I know, the whole thing is so formal, isn't it? Everyone was
really formal.
Was addressed as, you know, Mr. and Mom, and
it was all sir and mom. Yeah. It was almost like, you know, when you are in the army or in school and like there are just specific names that you use. It's not even about like who's more senior than the other. Like the examiners were calling the candidates sir and mom and vice versa, regardless of like your station, which I really liked.
So yeah, the way they examine this, if you want to be a black cab driver, is you go to what's called an appearance.
It's almost like Oxford or Cambridge, isn't it? All the like weird vocab quirks.
You go to an appearance and it's a one-on-one exam with, you know, someone who's already a cabbie of many years standing and, you know, who was really good at the test when they did it. And yeah, they ask you where something is in London and you have to tell them the street. And then they tell you another street and you have to recite with no hesitation the route that you would take road by road turning left or right, etc., mm-hmm. to get from one place to the other. And they mark you down for every time you deviate from what they think is the best and fastest route. And, you know, you have to get a sufficient number of points to go to the next stage, and you have to pass four stages of this exam.
Yeah, and they call that scoring, don't they? So they say, oh, sorry, you haven't scored today, or yes, you have scored, congratulations, you may proceed to the next level. Again, it's another thing that has very specific language when they're giving the directions. I'm paraphrasing here, but like, okay, so right on Leopold Street, forward New Cross Road, forward, and that just means like the road name has changed, but they have to say every time the road name changes when you're going down it. And then comply roundabout, they always say comply roundabout to make it clear that they are complying with the roundabout. And then I'd go in on the right, sir or ma'am, you know, like, and then you're there. It's amazing to watch because the level of concentration is obviously massive. And they also all talk about seeing. So if you're not able to visualize the route in your mind, then you're not going to do very well on that particular test. So you get candidates saying things like, oh, I'm just not seeing anything. My mind's gone blank. I'm not seeing the route at all. I'm not seeing that one. And then they move on to another one. Or the examiner is saying, can you see anything? You know, nothing at all. You can't see anything at all. Yeah, just really fascinating because it gives you a window into how their minds are actually working. And it is obviously clearly like something that comes out of the practice of doing the knowledge, which most people seem to do on motorbikes. So some people do in little cars, which is just spending hours and hours and hours out on a motorbike and just doing these routes over and over again. And like literally visually familiarizing yourself with the London landscape. Mm. And I think although a lot of people are clearly using maps to revise from at home, it's very much something that you have to learn firsthand out on the streets rather than just like in a room revising from a, you know, A to Z.
Yeah, and it's clearly something that people with visual memories will do better at anyway. But yeah, just the sheer brute work involved is absolutely incredible. But then, as I feel like we now know that things like Uber, Lyft, etc. are available, we know the difference between getting into a black cab and being able to say, I would like to go to X Road, please. And then the cab just moving off and then you get there in the quickest amount of time. And getting into an Uber and then them putting in the postcode and then them following the directions on their phone. And sometimes the phone directing them to the wrong place. And you as the passenger having to be very actively engaged in, well, actually it's here on the right, or, oh no, that's a dead end, you can't go down there. Because you've actually got more experience of the route than the driver has.
Mm. I never thought about it that way because I'm not someone who really takes taxis or Ubers or anything very much. So I was actually shocked to realise how, I don't know why, I just thought that if you hailed a black cab and you got in it, they'd be using sat-nav like anyone else. But it's just not the case at all. And I was literally walking around London today just like with a newfound respect for every single black cab that I saw, because you think, wow, you've had your appearances, you've got the knowledge, like that is amazing. It's like a ridiculous challenge. Like at one point the narrator compares it to the amount you would have to learn to get a law degree or a medicine degree. The amount of pure information is the same. Like, that's mad.
Yeah, and it's applied in the same way. It's not just about recall. You know, you have to be able to navigate the city and respond to things. And, you know, as road layouts change, you've got to change with them and all this kind of thing. So yeah, it really is an extraordinary feat. It made me think of the Sherlock Holmes story, A Study in Scarlet, adapted in the BBC Sherlock as A Study in Pink, in which, spoiler alert, the main murderer is hiding out as a cab driver. And in the original Conan Doyle story, obviously he's like driving a carriage, not a car. And then in the adaptation, he's a black cabbie. But what both of them have in common is that the cab driver is this figure who goes everywhere but is seen by nobody and who knows the city better than anybody and is therefore able to go outside of the rules and do what he wants because he understands the parameters of what's possible in London more than anyone else.
Yeah,
so watching people do that exam, I was like, oh, I see where Conan Doyle got the kind of germ of this idea from.
Yeah, definitely. And I do think, although it's, you know, that's a piece of fiction, I do think there is something comforting to me in the idea now of getting a black cab, because the statistics in terms of the number of drivers that sign up to Uber or Lyft or any of these mobile apps is so much higher than the amount of people getting through a knowledge exam every month. And it is a filter. And I just think there's something that kind of concerns me about mobile apps, because and I don't want to get too deep into this, but I know people who've had terrible experiences in, and there are checks and things involved in becoming a black cab driver that are really comforting to me. And I do think, not that I'm someone who gets taxis very often, but I am definitely going to try and stick to black cabs in the future, because it was just amazing to see, A, the amount of work going in, and you want to reward that level of work, but also very reassuring to see that these are like people who have to go through a really rigorous like checking system, so that you know that they're like safe people who have worked really hard to get into this job and don't want to jeopardize it by doing anything dodgy.
I once had a black cab driver make the case to me. It was quite soon after Uber had started in London, and he said, there are just so many circumstances in which we're better, it's almost hard for me to pick one, but he said, if you leave your wallet in the cab, if you call the TfL lost property service and you tell them where I picked you up and where I dropped you off, they'll be able to find me and I will have your wallet and I will get it back to you,
which is great,
which is amazing. And he said, you know, heaven forbid you want to make a complaint or a crime is committed while you're in my cab, I have a number around my neck, they can find me, you know. And then he evoked to me, you know, that ad that they put up everywhere where it said, if your mini cab's not booked, it's just a stranger's car.
That was horrific. That was kind of like gross and a bit exploitative, but made a point.
His point, I think, was well made, is that what is Uber if not just a stranger's car?
Exactly.
But also, it's worth saying that being a black cab driver, you know, you earn a decent living doing it. So
it costs more.
It costs more to take them because you're buying this incredible expertise and knowledge. But it also means for the people doing it, it's worth it to them. They're not being exploited in the way that Uber drivers are, say.
Yeah, exactly. So a real wake-up call, an amazing documentary just on a human level, because you're literally seeing these people like sweat and bleed to achieve their dreams, which is obviously a trope of documentaries, but like still so compelling. But yeah, also just really made me think about how I travel in London.
London pride has been handed down to us. London pride is a flower that's free. London pride means our own dear town to us, and our pride it forever will be. Woe, Liza, see the Costa barrels, the vegetable marrows, and the fruit piled high. Oh, Liza, little London sparrows, Covent Garden Market where the custards cry.
So last time we decided to have a go at one of your recommendations, which was the My Favourite Murder podcast, which is a two-handed podcast made by Karen Kilgariff and Georgia Hardstark in the US. And it's a kind of new twist on the ever popular true crime podcast genre, in which these two women, one of whom is a stand-up comedian, the other one is not, I don't think. Anyway, they chat through true crime news topics and cases.
Yeah, it's kind of a blend of like a true crime podcast and a like culture review podcast like ours, because it's two friends chatting about true crime cases as though they're sort of like episodes of TV that they've been binging on, and they'll be like, oh my god, remember when this bit happened?
Yeah.
So it's very much in that kind of chatty, shocked style, but about things that really happened and were real cases.
It's really fun, and it's been going for quite a while now. They've done 64 episodes, I think, you know, quite a lot. One thing I will say about this is the episodes are a lot longer than I thought they were going
to
be.
Well, I actually listened to the first one, which I know is kind of like a bad thing to do with podcasts, because podcasts tend to improve so much, and especially in the way that they get less rambly and less long. Often when people start podcasts, they're just like, we'll talk for as long as we want to talk, and then they like tighten it up as they go along. But I did find that with the first episode. I don't know if you listened to any later ones.
So I listened to episode 63, which I
think both ends of the spectrum then.
Is good. Just shy of 2 hours long.
Right, yeah, it's a long podcast.
Which is a really long podcast. And also, because I wasn't really sure what to expect from its format, you know, we got quite a lot of like banter between the hosts, banter between them and someone called Stephen. Not really sure who Stephen is. I think Stephen's
there.
They kept saying that Stephen is their intern, but I don't know if that was a joke or whether he actually is their intern. But anyway, there's about 20 minutes of that before we actually got onto them recommending each other some new true crime podcasts that they'd both been listening to, and they talked about that for a while. And I kept being like, well, where's your favourite murder then?
Which one's the favourite?
Which is, I now realise, not the correct way to listen to this podcast, because as you say, it's very much a discursive hangout with two friends.
Yeah.
But I don't know, for some reason in my head, I thought they were going to pick a favourite murder each week.
Well, they do in the first episode. I don't know what the we should have maybe listened to like the entire back episode of this podcast before discussing it, but that would have taken a really long time. In the first episode, they do say, okay, my favourite murder is this and my favourite murder is this. And I think Georgia picks JonBenet Ramsey and Karen picks something that I didn't know about called like the East Area Rapist, which was from a town that she grew up in. One thing I will say about this podcast is these two women are very different, I think, from us in their approach to true crime, because I'm someone who's like a complete baby and like literally worries about the ethical implications of everything until like the end of the day, all day. Like, I remember going to see Room and finding Room moving and like wanting to beat myself up about it for like 4 days straight, because I was like, no, this is unethical. This is like someone's life. This fictional story was in a way based on someone's life, and therefore I cannot appropriate their experiences by finding this moving. which is obviously completely ridiculous and the opposite extreme. These two are much more chatty, jovial. They will make kind of like quite edgy jokes about the subject matter they're discussing, and the fact that it is real life for some people doesn't impact on the way that they talk about it as though it's fiction, which can be really refreshing if you are someone who's really, really into true crime stories and just wants to discuss them unashamedly and find enjoyment in them. That's definitely what this podcast is doing. For someone like me, I'm like, oh God.
Yeah, I know what you meant. I have, I think maybe not quite to the same degree as you, but I do have that kind of, but what does it mean? What is it for? Like meta squeamishness about true crime generally. And I've only been getting more and more thoughts about this as, you know, more podcasts, S-Town, etc. come out. The general culture is now starting to question these things more than it used to. Like, you know, when Serial came out in 2014, everyone was just like, oh my God, a podcast that is really good. I like listening to it. It wasn't really till towards the end of the season that people were sort of saying like, well, hang on, who is this representing and what does this mean? Mm-hmm. But now I feel like those are the kind of questions that every true crime podcast gets asked right from the beginning. Missing Richard Simmons, which we talked about before, is a really good example of a podcast that was really popular, but almost instantly notorious because listeners were like, hang on, quite early on.
They're talking about the bare facts of the cases rather than representations of those cases in the media. So they are more free to just kind of talk about them as though these are things happening to people they know. Another area where we're different is that I'm like super, super worried about us like getting in trouble. So I'll be careful about what I say about Uber, for example, because I don't want to end up with a lawsuit. And I don't really know how it all works in podcasting, but they're very free saying things like, well, I think JonBenet's dad did it. And you're like, oh, wow, we're just going to say that on this podcast, which, I mean, why not? If people are saying that, you know, at the water cooler, then why shouldn't that be reflected in podcasting? But also, I'm a bit like, wow, really hope you don't get sued.
Yes, I think maybe what we're saying is that these women are a lot ballsier than we are.
Yeah, of course.
And
like power to them for that, definitely.
Yes, and that you should go and listen to their podcast because it is really good.
So we've picked another recommend from the recommend bin. This is an email from Selma. Thanks so much, Selma, for emailing in. First of all, she just has to say it. Long-time listener, first-time recommender. She is a Brit currently living in Sweden, and she wants to recommend us a mobile game in the style of Monument Valley or Prune. So she says she's going to recommend us the game she played when her Monument Valley withdrawal set in, called Lumino City. It's a puzzle game about a girl exploring a city while looking for her kidnapped grandfather. It's also crafted entirely by hand, made from paper and tiny motors. The graphics might actually be the best ones I've ever encountered. I believe it won a BAFTA or two as well. Warning though, it's incredibly frustrating at points, and yes, the music is good. So that sounds really exciting.
This sounds perfect. And yeah, I'm excited to do another game, not least because you've got a couple of long flights coming up, and I feel like this could be a good thing for you.
Yeah, definitely. Thanks for listening to this episode of Seriously, the pop culture podcast from The New Statesman.
If you enjoyed the show, why not subscribe to make sure you never miss another episode? We're available in all the usual places you get podcasts, including iTunes, where you can also leave us a review if you'd like.
At our website, seriouslypod.com, you can find all our back episodes, plus our specials on Home Alone, Gilmore Girls, Harry Potter, Love Actually, and Friends.
We're available many other places on the internet, including on Twitter, Facebook, and Tumblr. We're seriouslypod on all of them. Don't forget that our Twin Peaks quiz on the 9th of May is now on sale. Head over to seriouslypod.com/events to get your tickets before they're all gone.
We love getting a recommendations for things we should feature on the show, or just hearing your thoughts on what we've discussed. Get in touch on social media or email us on seriouslypod@gmail.com.
And if you feel strongly that more pop culture needs to be taken seriously, spread the word and tell your friends and family about the podcast.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.